One of the questions that we see pop up every now and again in Facebook groups or online forums, Reddit, even ordinary chats at barbecues and cafes with friends of friends and all that, it's around this whole buying a house in a family trust. Or even if we step back, should we set up a family trust to invest or hold our assets? It is a little bit nuanced, but I really believe for most people, most of the time, it's mostly not needed to have a family trust. But we're going to just talk about that today and just really help you understand why it might or might not be needed in your life, particularly buying a house that you live in your family trust. Today, I'm joined by John Pidgeon, the host of the This Is Property podcast and regular OG over here at This Is Money. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Glenn.
Today's episode is brought to you by Sphere Home Loans. Now, did you know over 70% of Aussies now use a mortgage broker, which says a few things. A, the brokers, they're probably pretty good at what they do. B, it suits your needs. So they will come to you via, so they will talk with you where you're at online, all G. And it also means they're probably really getting you the most appropriate mortgage deal for your situation. We're pro mortgage broker here for a variety of reasons. If you are looking at buying your first home, refinancing your existing home, buying another property, or just wanting a chat about a bit of direction of some savings targets for a mortgage for your situation, you can search Sphere Home Loans or click the link in the show notes and they'll be able to help you wherever you are. My name is Glenn James and this is Money.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
John, before we get into it, I just want to shout out a listener in the Facebook group, Ambrielle. I think that's how I pronounce her name. I can't believe I actually got the keys to my first home today. And then a excited emoji. A year ago, I thought it was just a pipe dream. But look at me now. Self-employed, single parent, and recovering BNPL addict over here. She read the Simo book, Sort Your Money Out and Get Invested. She listened to This Is Money podcast, this one right here, and worked with an amazing broker to turn her finances around. Now, I'm officially a homeowner. Thank you. So this is what we talk about. Things are possible. It doesn't usually happen overnight or next month or in 2 months, but it's just so surprising once you start to get focused and pay attention the results that you can receive.
Totally. That is an unbelievable story. I haven't told you this, Glenn. I'm going off script for a minute. I was in a hospital in Victoria last week.
Fully, are you all right?
Fully
or
gowned.
Are you visiting or?
No, I was a patient, but all's good. And a nurse came in and was actually in tears saying, look, I listened to your podcast. For the last 6 years, and just last month, I bought my first property in Melbourne, and she was just over the moon. And
wow,
it's just unbelievable to hear these stories. And like 6 years of just educating, and as I said, self discipline, and you get the result, and she's up and away.
So you're like mid heart attack.
Yes.
She's frothing over you. You're like, that's good, but I'm dying. Help, help.
It was literally like 10 o'clock at night. She just clocked on a shift and I'm just twiddling my thumbs and yeah, it was a cool moment. So
do you want to, can you tell people, like, I don't know, I'm a bit of a pervy type. I want to know the info, and you hear people and they're like, oh, I was in hospital.
Yeah.
Like, what was wrong? Just tell us.
Yeah. So look, I don't want to go into too much detail, but I was on a charity bike ride. I was halfway up Mount Hotham. I was a bit of a, fatigue and dizziness set in. Long story short, got into Wangaratta Hospital. Atrial fibrillation had occurred. Heart had gone back into rhythm normally, so all was good, but had to run a whole heap of tests in the meantime, and they don't let you go until it's all good. So, yeah, that was in the process of that. So we're fitting well, and we get to meet new people.
You are like a turd that won't flush, aren't you? You just can't get rid of you.
No. I had to check with our good friends to make sure our insurances are up to date, though. Don't worry.
I'm thinking I should get some bloody key first insurance on you. I might make a quick buck.
Nah, we're all good.
Awesome. Hey, Susanna in the Facebook group. Hi, everyone. You are always the first group I think of when it comes to all things money. I have a question about entering a family trust to buy a house. Has anyone done this before? What are the pros and cons? What are the important things to know before entering into one? I think it's important to maybe we talk about family trusts first, John, as a structure. I have a family discretionary trust. You have a family discretionary trust. Like, what do you tell your clients about family trusts in general?
Yeah, and you're right. It is in general, and I suppose we educate on the positives and the negatives, and then they make their own decision, having spoken to their accountant or their solicitor, whatever it might be. But generally speaking, I've rarely seen it done. Probably 1% in to buy the family home in a trust. Generally, is why would we do it? Well, we do it for cash flow. And we do it for maybe asset protection. So that's where a lot of people will question it. Do we buy our family home in a trust for that asset protection? Might be a doctor or someone that's open to litigation. But I suppose the downsides are, I think, more prevalent than the upsides, and in respect to the interest rates might be a touch higher. There's a lot more paperwork. There's the upfront costs of setting the family trust up, the running of it. There's no concessions from the government because it's not in your personal name. All these factors lead most people to say, let's just have it in our own name.
Mm.
What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so on just the thing of family trusts, generally, more times than not, they would be set up if you're a business owner and you're running the business. You can run your business in a discretionary trust, and it's effectively a trading trust, right? So I could be a wall and floor tiler, and I've got a family trust and I just operate out of that. There's a corporate trustee, and at the end of the year, you might employ some people through that trust, and you have the discretion to distribute profits to beneficiaries. Now, while you might be thinking, oh, I should get this because then I can distribute profits, there's a little thing called PSI, personal services income, and that is income produced mainly from more than 50% from your skills or efforts as an individual. So like if you were like, oh, I'm a contractor and do project management and change management, and the trust is contracted, and then I do all the work and then I distribute the profits to my spouse or partner, you can't do it because it's PSI. But if the trust owns a business and that business employs people and it's a full-on operation, well, there's an argument there that we can distribute profits because it falls outside of the PSI. So for my business, I have an operating entity, Simo Interactive, which is a proprietary limited company, trading as This Is Money. That business is owned, or 100% of the shares in that business is owned by my discretionary family trust. And then because I'm a little bit of an entrepreneur, small business owner, when I did set up the family trust, it was set up to be my wealth creation vehicle for the rest of my life, effectively. So it's the most flexible for the stuff that I'll be looking at doing. I'm about to purchase a share in an industrial unit with cash through the trust, right? So my discretionary family trust will own a share of a unit trust that is a industrial unit with some friends and colleagues. So that, for me, my family trust is my wealth hub, okay? I've got a couple of specky unlisted investments from like Birchall, for example, and other, you know, really speculative things that I own through the family trust. I've just got the view that all my investing assets, apart from residential property, which we can get into that, is owned by my family trust. My previous financial planning business, it was a unit trust, and that was owned by my current family trust. So the current family trust doesn't go anywhere, but throughout the course of my life, it will be owning different assets. It's got a equity, it's got an equity portfolio in the family trust. I've got a CoinSpot account owned by the family trust. So there are no investments other than my investment properties that are owned in my name. Now, John, with this thing around asset protection, it does enter the chat a little bit. So my wealth in, you know, my equity account, the little bit of crypto that I've got, the other startups, this industrial commercial property, all of that is not in the name of Glenn James. So if I was sued tomorrow, I do have investment properties. Some of them, you know, have around a 50% LVR. So there is some, because you got to think, asset protection, you could literally have your house, right, have a full mortgage against it, leave money in the offset account, and that there's asset protection there with the bank lien over the house, with the mortgage.
Mm.
I mean, they could come and try and get the equity, but it is just another barrier. But I think all that to say, I just wanted to use this example that if you're an employee, it's going to be a very, very limited circumstance where you would want your family trust to be set up to hold your investments, because it just, it doesn't make sense. Now, there's always a bell curve. There's always a carve out. Everyone's situation is different. If you got a knock on the door, ready? Hello, who is it? Oh, yes, it's the lottery office, or yes, it's a big inheritance office. Here's $10 million. Like, you might, okay, well, let's set up a structure. Let's do that as our investment vehicle.
Hmm.
But in the main, we see all this stuff online, like, yeah, I've got a family trust. Yeah, do this. Yeah, do that. And we think, oh, maybe I should be sophisticated.
Yes.
And set up a trust, because that's what successful people do. And that means I can make more money and it's set up better. But that bell curve of not needing one to a bell curve of most people not needing one.
Yeah.
And then this is like down the other side of, yes, you probably do need one for your situation.
Yeah. And I think when someone runs with that theory or concept, they chat to their accountant, and the good accountants will outline the pros and cons and you can make your own decision. Others may, and shout out to all our good accountants around the country, may say, yeah, no worries, let's set that up and run with that. The big one with our family home, though, is when we get to the topic of selling that property and the capital gains tax. All of a sudden, your 50% of your capital gains is now payable, as opposed to having it in your personal name where there's no capital gains tax on your principal place.
Yeah, and I want to get onto that a little bit more, but I'll just finish for those who are really interested in the business side of having the family trusts and different entities. So my operating company, who employs our staff here, who receives revenue from ads and everything that we do, that is owned by my family trust. I'm a director of that company as well. So any profits can go back to the family trust as a dividend effectively, and then farmed out through my family trust. And, you know, if I'm married one day, I can bring my spouse in as a beneficiary if they choose not to work or whatever. But if they're working as a professional earning 250, 300 grand a year, well, it's not real use distributing because all roads lead to the highest tax rate in Rome. But as an example, some of the things that we've done to really structure my business up for the long term is all our intellectual property. So all the trademarks, this is money, this is property, this is work, this is investing, all our RSS feeds. So for the podcast, which is the asset, all of that staff is actually owned by my family trust. And I've got a license agreement that Simo Interactive licenses the brand from my family trust. So if one day I wanted to sell my business and brand, well, the actual assets are owned by the family trust, which, and this kind of flows through into a broader discussion around asset sale, and you touched on it with CGT. If you have assets owned in a company, there is no capital gains tax. You've got the company tax rate. Now, if you're a trading company, and this is where I get advice, your tax rate's probably that 20, is it 25%? I even forget, 25, 27%. I think they'll bring it down at staged. I need to check that out. But if you've just got a company that you have shares in and it's an investment company, tax rate's 30%. So if I've got a big asset, so, you know, hypothetically, if this is money, the brand is worth millions of dollars and I decide to sell that, well, the owner of that, if it was the company, 30%, bam. Where if it's in the trust, there could be some provisions around, and it's really hard because it's not something I'm doing immediately and I'd have to get in the weeds, but there could be a concession that I can use that can flow through to my own name or retirement into, like, yeah, it can, yeah, it's probably beyond the scope of now. It's a bit more technical, but all that to say, they're really useful. And finally, before we get onto the actual property in trusts, one of the good things about trusts and trust law, if your company is sued, it's all flows back to the Corporations Act, the Corps Act, right? But because the trust as an entity is not a company, it falls out of the Corps Act. So it's more of a precedent law and, you know, a bit more discretion, and it can be more nuanced. And either if you look at it, it could be more favorable to run a business through a trust than a company. So all this to say, this, you pull this thread and it gets quite complicated quite fast. But now if we go back to what you were talking about, John, if you had the family home in a family trust, well, it's not in your name. The asset isn't in your name. It's effectively in an investment vehicle, and you throw a whole heap of concessions out the window in the name of asset protection, where I'd be like, well, I'll just be taking the risk having it in my own name. So at least if I sell it, I can get a CGT discount for my principal place of residence. But there are other things like, John, that surgeon that you might have talked about who's could be litigated, there are strategies to help minimize with, we put it in a non-firing line spouse's name, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what you've got to explore first and foremost before just rushing to set up a family trust. But yeah, and one of the key benefits of a family trust is flexibility, isn't it? Like distributions to beneficiaries, etc. So when you've got your own family home, conceptually, there's no distributions, is there? There's no income being associated with it. So that's where it loses its appeal.
I've met one person who has their home in a family trust.
Have you? Now, I haven't met anyone.
Really? Yeah. And so, and this is why I would say they're a ultra high net worth family.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking over $100 million.
Right.
Maybe half a billion dollar net worth, right? And if the house was worth $10 million, right? Yeah, throw it in the trust, whatever. Like it gets to the point where it's like, we just have to do this.
Yeah.
For a variety of reasons, and depending on the type of trust in terms of if that person, if you are a primary beneficiary or a secondary beneficiary, it may protect the asset from obviously litigation, but also any family law stuff, which family law can pierce a lot of corporate veils.
Yeah.
But if there is a case where there is the family home is in a trust that the parents own and it's the parents' trust and all that. But this is so unique, and I don't know many people that are worth you know, $500 million. But for everyone else out there, well, we probably just keep our family home in our individual names.
Yeah. And your example maybe might be a classic one of, well, I'm not fussed about any capital gains tax discounts or anything like that. I'm just simply wanting asset protection and we can legacy this property to our kids and it's safe and secure.
Yeah. And I think, and that's the thing, like picture this, everyone, you're worth $150 million. You buy a house for $4 million with cash in a family trust and sell it a year later for an extra million, paying a bit of tax. It gets to the point, it's like, whatever, it's not moving the needle on the overall situation.
Yeah, because the asset protection's far greater.
That's right. So what I want to talk about with this family trust thing and you touched on it, John, if you're buying investment properties within a family trust, well, you're entering into the commercial lending world, which can have a higher interest rate. You and I were talking to someone the other day who was lending for a commercial property. The rate was the same as a home loan because there was a 30% down, right? Yeah. So it's not impossible, but a lot of the time, if you've got a higher LVR, you'll end up with a higher in that commercial world. So it will be more expensive.
Yeah.
And just talk to us about land tax thresholds with buying investment properties in entities.
Yeah. So, well, that's another podcast on its own because, yeah, recently in Victoria, the land tax alterations have been made. So it doesn't matter what you've got your buying entity in, the land tax is now applicable. So it's definitely, first of all, relative to the state in which you are living in. But generally speaking, land tax is going to be payable from the first dollar. There are essentially no concessions. Whereas in your personal name, you might have investment properties in, I don't know, New South Wales, for example, and there might be a concession up to 500K in land value, for example. And then once you've got a value of land that exceeds that, that's when you start paying land tax. Whereas in a family trust or a lot of company structures, you'll pay land tax right from the first dollar of land ownership.
Now, another thing with family trusts, which you need to know with the investment properties, one of the big reasons why you wouldn't do it, particularly if it is a negatively geared property, is you can't distribute losses from the trust each year. They just keep accumulating in the trust. So you'd want them in the trust to offset future gains, but you distribute profit from discretionary trusts onto the tax return of the beneficiaries, primary or secondary, but you can't distribute losses.
Yes.
So it
trapped.
It comes a no, don't dick around with property in family trusts for most people most of the time ever. Like, it just comes to that. Now, Susanna, you could turn around and go, oh, Glenn, thanks for that. Made a lot of sense. We just won the US Powerball and have $500 million now and the shoe could fit. But
yeah,
it's a great discussion. And like the self-managed super fund discussion, most people don't need one.
No.
I've got one. John's got one. But we have a little bit more complex financials than the average bear who's got a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And that's not elitist or whatever. That's just the facts. I've run multiple businesses over the years. I've done really well financially. For my personal situation, it stacks up to have a self-managed super fund and like John's. But we want you to get to the fact that you're doing really well financially and you can look at these scenarios, but you might never get there because you're doing really well financially and you're an employee and you've got a really lean investment system and you're happy with everything. So, yeah, I love these discussions.
So, like an example in, I just did a quick online land tax estimator for Queensland. If you've got 600K worth of land value in Queensland, either in owned in a company or a trust, your land tax payable is 5,700.
Right? For 600K
of land value, Right. Yeah. So
it could be three properties, two or three properties, would you think?
Yeah, or one.
Or one, yeah, I guess, yeah.
But
depends what part of Queensland you're in.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But if you're if that 600 is in your personal name, you're basically paying zero land tax.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've got to.
So, do you want to pay $6,000 a year for the pleasure of the asset protection? And
that's what you need to put all the pros and the cons on the table and have a conversation with the key people in your life.
So, that would be the land tax. So, it's like I've got my family home. It's worth 1.2, for example. Half of the value is the land. The fact that I want some quote-unquote asset protection put in the trust, I'm paying an extra $5,700 a year for that privilege.
That's right.
And yeah, foregoing any CGT concessions if the value of the property increases and I sell the house.
Yeah, and I've actually got a client in that situation, not their principal place, but their investments, where they're happy to pay land tax each year because it's an asset protection thing. They run their own business in agriculture and that's just the way they want it. But we factored in the numbers before they bought the property. And I think that's the key element there is a lot have a look at these structures and like, oh, yeah, and I'm a sophisticated investor now. That's what I need. And then all of a sudden, 12 months later, get a land tax bill. It's like, wow, where did that come from?
But there's a huge chasm of daylight when we're looking at property and family trusts between your PPOR and an investment property.
Mm. Oh, totally. Like
I get the investment property. You might do it in the family trust for whatever reason. But yeah, there's a lot of daylight to have the case of getting your PPOR in a discretionary trust.
Yeah.
I actually had a client once and it was just, oh, it was wild. They came to me. And I still can't believe it. And I know the suburb was Matcham on the Central Coast, right?
Lovely.
And you would say it's probably one of the most exclusive little mini acre, the Dural-esque of Sydney, like insert your premium couple of acreage, lush, like you've basically got to be rich to live there. That's the long and the short. They rocked up for some advice and they had their family home owned in Matcham that they were living in. Not in a trust, my friends. Not in a trust. In a friggin' company.
Mm.
And
was that an oversight or just
I think they just, we're a DIY, yeah, we'll do this. And that's the thing. It's like you could earn good money and have great money, but you can make some ill-advised financial decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And we say it a lot, absolutely. Mm.
And that's what we're here for. We're here to advise you on not buying property in trusts most of the time.
You could argue that the Matcham capital growth on would have exceeded the land tax. But if you can avoid it, you're still going to be better off.
Yes, but the capital growth, like if it grew a couple of $1 million, would you want to pay CGT on that?
That would be a nasty surprise.
And remember, company tax rate, this isn't trusts we can distribute out to beneficiaries and all that stuff. Anyway, so Les, I just wanted to park on this one for a couple of moments. Does $1,900 a year comprehensive insurance sound about right for a 26-year-old with no claims history, car insured for $8,700 and a $750 excess? I shopped around online, haven't called, but I'm just unpleasantly surprised. I was expecting around $900 at my age, edited for more info, got my license at 18 and the car is a Hilux. I use two comparison websites plus two different insurers directly, considering just getting CTP. What are your thoughts? So in my limited experience of being a human being with cars, I've actually resolved, similar to what Celeste has resolved, that most car insurance companies are within about the same price. Because when you actually do like-for-like comparisons, so I did one the other day, for example. I went to the Budget Direct website, which their advertisers the cheapest and all that. Then I went over to GIO or NRMA or one of those ones, and did a comparison, and I did like for like. It was basically the same price.
Was it?
And I think some of these UEs of the world and Budget Directs of the world, their default offering is cheaper because they might not automatically include windscreen protection or might not automatically include XYZ. So I've really resolved most of the time, most insurers are going to be in the same ballpark because they're probably getting the same actuarial data from the same source. And Celeste's found that out. Now, a couple of things that probably can impact the price of this. I jumped on and did a quote for a Hilux. I think I just did a 2010 twin cab for a 26-year-old and all that. And I was only guessing, but it was, around that 900 a year. So it could well be the postcode or suburb that has just had huge crime and just went to town. Like, I think that's all it would be if every insurer is very expensive.
Yeah, and you might just reverse engineer that and change the postcode to somewhere that sounds a little bit more ritzy and see what that does. But also the excess amount, right? We know that the policy's cheaper if you bump the excess up. So you've just, at the end of the day, you have insurance. It's almost a fear factor, isn't it? It's like, well, if I don't have it, I'm in trouble. Now, Celeste says, well, considering just getting CTP, what are your thoughts on that? Like that's, most people would say, well, that's fraught with danger, because I haven't got comprehensive insurance.
Well, I'll just I just want to unpack this. It probably is different state-based. I don't live in every state, but in New South Wales.
Every slip, in New South Wales, every colour slip under the planet.
Yeah, but CTP stands for compulsorily third party. So everyone has to pay that, and that basically covers blood and bones of humans, okay? And that's compulsory. So if you're in an accident, there is insurance to cover blood and bones. What the options are would be third-party damage, or sometimes they call it third-party fire and theft. So I honestly believe if you are going to take the risk and not get comprehensive, and this could be what Celeste is actually thinking, not the compulsory third party, but opting for a optional third party damage. So at least if you're in an accident and you hit something that's very expensive, it doesn't flush you.
Mm.
And I'd be looking at that. But my comment to Celeste would be, I think I read that she paid $13,000 for the ute. I'm probably, as you said, John, that was a good pickup, plugging some different postcodes in and seeing if you can kind of fault find on what the actual thing is, or changing it to male or female, just to really work out. Or, I don't know if they would even do this, jumping on the phone and be like, is there any actual discretion here that you can manually look at this?
Mm.
Because it is parked off the street. It is in a garage.
Yeah.
You've just got to make sure.
You mean actually talking to a human?
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
I don't think they'll be able to manually do it, but it might be worth a phone call.
Totally.
But I think I would rather you self-insure either $2,000, so have the highest excess. One of the websites I went on, they allowed you to have like a $2,000 excess. I would rather really high excess and the full $13,000 amount, or you might say, I'll do $8,000 and $1,000 excess. I'm definitely at the very least getting third party damage.
Absolutely. No brainer.
But I'd love to know where you ended up with that one, Celeste. So maybe you can tag me in your original comment And we'll have a chat about it.
But just to finish on that, insurance policies are getting more expensive. They're not coming down in Australia, are they?
No. Everything is a joke. It costs you to wake up of a morning. I don't know. Oh, anyway, we'll be back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Okay, now it is time for the community segment of the week where we ask you in the Facebook group a heap of different questions and we read them out here on the podcast. This segment is brought to you by Sky Wealth. I'm a big believer that you need to protect the most important thing in your life, and that is your ability to earn, or if you were to die, there is protection in place for your family. You can reach out to sky.com.au or just search Sky Wealth and have a chat to them today about getting your income protection sorted and your whole suite of insurances. All right, here we go. Side hustles. We asked everyone in the Facebook group, share your side hustles below. Nicola, I just soft launched a couple of custom AI tools and I've made a casual $26,000 in 4 days. It's wild.
Yeah, is that a typo? Wowee.
Nah.
Braden, flat pack and play equipment assembly. Whoa, good
that's
luck.
Good. Yeah, that's awesome.
Do you like doing that? It's the worst, surely.
John said, I made built on and plan to sell it commercially in the future. Hang on.
Josh,
what is that built on? Oh, it's it looks like beef jerky type dried steak stuff.
Yeah.
Built on is a form of dried cured meat which originated in the southern African countries. Well, there you go. When you go home from work today, John, when Amy says, what did you learn today at work? You can tell her.
Biltong. Might make it, batch. Hayley, Auslan tutoring. Mm. More and more in need as the world gets older.
Jake, wedding videography. Mm, that's cool.
Jenna says, I sell my hobbies. So I sew bags, clothes, do sublimation and make things out of leather.
What's sublimation? Let's Google this. I'm a bogan. Sublimation. Here we go. Sublimation is the transition of substance directly from the solid to the gas state without passing through the liquid state.
Yes, that's science 101, isn't it?
What's she selling? Anyway, that's, yeah. Mm. Anyway, there you go. Whatever that is, it might be something else.
Yeah.
It's so weird because she sews bags and clothes and make things out of leather. So I wonder if sublimation means like you're turning something into something else.
Not gas.
Yeah.
Sarah says, I make freeze-dried candy and occasionally smoked meat catering.
Yeah. Phil, I've just started making heavy-duty horse and animal feed bins. Just completed one for my first client for Ram, 700 profit.
Wow.
My first client for Ram. Might be a typo there, but awesome. Mm. That's good. $700. Yeah. I'll take it.
Absolutely. And Haley says, handmade by Haley. Handcrafted polymer clay jewelry, 3D printed cookie cutters and indoor plant accessories. So Haley's all over it.
That's so good.
Got a good tune to it, handmade by Haley.
Yeah. I think you can probably find her on Instagram or something. Sounds like it's a bit of a thing. Actually, I'll have a look now. Let's just have a look and see if she's got an Instagram called Handmade by
It's exactly what she wanted you to do, live. Yeah,
she knew that she was leading the witness.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Hook, line, and sphincter. Yes, handmade, hand. Oh, no, that's Harley. Or is it Harley?
No.
Have you got it open?
Yeah, it's Haley.
Oh, handmade by, how did you spell
Haley
it?
Lewis.
Haley, I closed it.
H-A-Y-L-E-Y.
Handmade by Haley. Scrunchy_co. That could be her.
Mm. Sounds.
If it's not. So.
Jewelry and indoor plant accessories.
All right. Well, this Haley was doing scrunchies. So
another random
you,
Haley's got some airtime.
Yeah. On you, all the Haleys out there. Oh, here. What did that one say? She did.
Handcrafted polymer clay jewelry. Still can't say it right. 3D.
Are you sure you're? Hey, go back to the hospital and be like, hey, you guys are in here. You're looking at my heart, but I think I've had a stroke.
It took my brain.
Anyway, all G. Let's bump out into some housekeeping. Okay. All we're talking about at the moment is the Financially Fierce podcast hosted by Jess Brady. It is a separate podcast. If you're into money, if you're into a different vibe, if you're into a different view, Jess will help you shape your money mindset, learn how to invest, curb your bad spending habits, and become financially fierce. So we really want to give Jess a platform. She's a great financial advisor. She's got a lot of strong opinions and views on the world, which is always great to have behind a microphone. And Financially Fierce, it is a growing podcast. We just want everyone, if you are interested in money content, and you're sick of me jabbering away and John friggin' slurring his words and not being able to speak good, you can listen to Financially Fierce. Secondly, Retire Right. This is interesting, John. So remember when we started My Millennial Money, it was like the first main big Aussie podcast that went big.
Yeah.
That was for Aussies by Aussies personal finance, right?
Yes, yes.
So I basically have done a rinse and repeat of that strategy with Retire Right. It's the first big mainstream money podcast for those over age 50, 55 talking about retirement.
Yeah, and so important. And what a time to be doing it with so many BBs rolling around, baby boomers.
Oh, I was going to say what? And like in the last 60 days, that Facebook group has grown over 300%.
Wow.
So we know we're onto something.
Wow.
So I want you to show your parents, show your grandparents, anyone in your life over age 50 or 55 looking to retire, the podcast Retire Right. It's hosted by Mark McGrath and I jump on and do the odd episode as well. But that's where a lot of my energy is going this year to really have that first big podcast. Because you got to think about it. None of the big radio networks are doing it. None of the big iHearts are doing it. None of the big networks are doing this stuff. We have seen a gap in the market and it is very, very popular with older Australians looking to retire.
Yeah. Had the luxury of getting on there myself the other day, which was having a good chat with Marty.
Well, there you go. All right. Let's get back into it, shall we? All right, John, Amy said, mortgage question here. If you apply for a pre-approval for a loan and you don't buy in the approved period, i.e. you're still looking after 3 or so months, Does this have a real impact on applying for pre-approval again? I've heard you don't want to have multiple applications because it looks bad on your credit report, but trying to understand what the real impact is. TIA, thanks in advance.
Yes, good question, Amy. Great name, by the way. I think generally not. If your pre-approval expires, you simply resubmit the application for a further 90 days or whatever the pre-approval will give you, and there shouldn't be any impact on your credit rating or your chances of getting approval unless your situation has changed, your borrowing capacity reduces, or you go and apply for multiple pre-approvals with different lenders. Now, this is the good thing about having a mortgage broker in your corner. As you mentioned at the top of the show, Glenn, we are pro mortgage broker here. So having one that can say, look, at the minute, now the 90 days is up, policies have changed, and this lender might actually be the best. So we might head over here and get a pre-approval over here. But they get the ability, or they have the ability, to communicate with that lender prior to putting in that application. So we ensure as best as we can to that you don't, you're not impacted by that.
Now, can you show me the top of your hand like that, John? Just the top of your hand.
There it is. That, yeah, like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm just tapping that as a naughty boy. Tap, tap, tap.
Yeah, right.
Naughty boy. I just want to correct. This is a 1% language thing, and also, you're right, but I'm just making entertainment. You said when the pre-approval expires, there's another application. It's not another application. Usually, it's a continued declaration that the situation hasn't changed.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's a great correction.
Because the only way something ends up on your credit file is if there has been a submission to the lender.
Correct.
Or an application, yes. Right? Now, like you said, if you went to three different banks and got three different pre-approvals on the fly, it was going to be three inquiries. You don't want to do that. You go to your broker, and an inquiry is potentially different than an actual application. When we formally apply, that is what.
But you're applying for a pre-approval extension, right?
Yeah, but it's not. They're not re-asking for heaven and earth. A lot of the time, they're like, "Has anything changed?"
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So no one's wrong here. You're just correcting for the sake of correcting, which is
fine. I'm just making entertainment. Yeah. I'm just going to call Rachel Croon from Sphere Home Loans
live. You know, I saw her at the doctor's yesterday.
It's freaking dying around here.
She wasn't there on a person.
Sphere Home Loans, Carl speaking.
Oh, hey, it's Glenn. I've called Rach's
Hey, she's overseas.
Work number. Oh, she's in Nepal still, is she?
Yeah.
No, she's away on a different trip, actually.
Oh.
She's not, yeah. Sorry, is there anything I can help you with?
No, I was just going to have a bit of a chat, but that's all good. Actually,
I've got Courtney here with me if you want to have a chat with her.
Is Joe around?
Yeah, give me one second. Glenn from My Millennial?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, sure. Give me one second. I'll see if he's available.
Yeah, sweet.
This is money, Jack.
This is like, so she has her mobile number.
That's converted.
And a personal one.
Yes.
I called the work one. And it's when she's away, she diverts to the office.
Hi, Glenn. How are you going?
Good, mate. Hey, just putting you on the spot. I'm actually recording a live podcast with John at the moment, so you will be recorded. It's a really easy question. Can you just talk us through what happens when someone applies for a pre-approval and at the end of the 3 months they haven't found a house? Like, what's the process for re-triggering the pre-approval period, and can it be indefinitely, or do lenders go, we'll do it for 6 months only before we need to fully have another look?
Yes, as a general rule for the majority of lenders, if after 3 months you haven't found someone, you do want to extend that pre-approval, they're going to request updated documentation for your income verification.
Yes.
So your payslip, obviously if you're self-employed, that's unlikely that that's going to change. But if you're PAYG, then they're going to want updated payslips. They may well request updated bank statements to continue to evidence that you've got the funds to complete. There are a few lenders that will just extend it without that, but the majority of the time you're going to need to provide those updated documents.
Yeah, but at that re-trigger to extend it, it's not as full-on as hectic as the application and all that information?
Absolutely not. So yeah. It's literally, we'll come back to you. So the way that we work in our system is we set a reminder a week before expiry. We come back to you and go, hey, I know you're still looking. Would you like to extend the pre-approval? Can we get those updated docs from you? They then send us through, the updated pay slips, and we go back to the bank saying, hi, guys, we just want to extend this for a further 180 days. Yep. And we provide them with those pay slips, and that's literally it.
Yeah. And do some lenders allow... You said 180 days. So some lenders would do a 6-month pre-approval, but they would check before settlement that things are still okay?
Well, let's just say, for example, some lenders will require updated payslips after 45 days.
Right.
Some require them after 30 days. It really does depend on the lender.
Yes.
So even if, let's say, for example, we've got a pre-approval in place and 40 days go past, let's just say, for example, I don't know, someone like St. George, they're going to request updated payslips. So if you ever have any prospective change in your employment during your pre-approval position, you need to let us know to make sure there's not a detrimental effect to your application.
Yeah, awesome. No, that's cool. We're just having a bit of a chat about this and we're going around in circles and it's just the magical, it depends, right?
It's incredibly dependent on your personal scenario and which lender you're going with.
Yeah. But on balance, it's not a big deal and it won't impact your credit if you extend the pre-approval. Awesome.
Not at all.
All right, mate. Really appreciate it. I'll catch you next time I'm floating around.
Sounds great. See you soon. Cheers.
Thanks. See you, mate. Bye.
Bye.
So there you go. That was Joe from Sphere Home Loans, one of the dedicated brokers to This Is Money team. But anyway, I think we got the answer there, didn't we, John?
We did indeed, yes. So, all in all, you need a buyer's agent basically to get your property sooner than the 90 days.
Do you know any? Oh, I was actually telling someone the other day when we did that live property event tour thing.
Yeah.
You're so crap at promoting your own services.
Yeah. Well, it's a fine balance between telling people you exist and not just ramming it down people's throats, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, you're good at ramming.
I'll ram like the best of them. I'll plow even.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, look, I'm happy to start promoting more. I just did in an organic way.
Yes, yeah, so that's right. Hey, I just want to read a quick statement that got a lot of chatter on the Facebook group. Jump in, have a read, have a search. But I just want to highlight one potential issue with this that isn't a showstopper. It's just a FYI, be alert and aware to this. Chelsea said, hey, guys, I'd love some insight, please, from working married women who did or didn't change their last name and why. I'm 28-year-old female getting married in a few weeks, congratulations, and trying to decide what to do. I originally intended to keep my name professionally but change it personally. Reason being, I have a 10-plus year career already, which I've worked hard for, but on the flip side, I love my partner and want us to have the same last name. Just getting to change his name to yours. Mm. However, recently I'm looking into an avenue of my work where I need to use my legal name in court and I think I have two names would be confusing, blah, blah, blah. Also relevant to note is that we do not plan on having kids, so having the same name as my kids or kid isn't that relevant to me. Interested to hear people's perspective and all that. So a lot there. I mean, John's speech at his wedding, he was like, oh, Amy, she's so beautiful. I love her. There was nothing I wanted to change about her, just her last name. That's all I wanted to change with Amy. Just, she's perfect.
Yeah.
But
she downgraded.
She's on the next episode of the podcast called Regrets in Life with Amy Pigeon. But what I want to just flag, and I've seen this out in the wild, and this is similar if you have a name that I was actually received an email this morning from an individual. His formal name, I don't know, how do you say this without sounding like you're a buffoon, arrogant, bogan, person or, you know.
The listeners insulting. Already know that.
Yeah, that's right.
Fine,
so
just go
I think
it.
Their origin was China and they used a name that was very Western, okay, as a first name.
Yep.
So in these situations, it's like getting married and keeping your name professionally and changing your name to the new name is the exact same boat for those who might come to Australia from a quote-unquote Eastern country and use a Western first name because it's just easier for whatever reason. You're just like, call me David and all that. So the trick is you've just got to always pay attention and be micro careful when you're doing flashpoints in your life. And that could be you go for a new job and they onboard you in the system as Amy Hoddenot.
Yes.
Where she's actually called Amy Pigeon or something like that.
Yeah.
That was her former name, everyone. And no. Yeah, that's it. So she wanted to use she wanted to change her actual name to Pigeon.
Yeah.
But she's kept Amy Hoddenot in professional. So she gets the job and like, yeah, what's your name? Amy Hoddenot or whatever.
Yeah.
And they onboard her as that and then they set up a Subaru account and it's got Amy Hoddenot, but it's not her name. Her real name's actually on paper, Amy Pigeon. So that's the only issue. If you've just got to pay attention, like if you wanted to use the name David, that they use your real name because it can just, it's in the main, it's not a big deal until it is. One day you want to roll out your super fund or you've got some salary packaging and HR have put your street name in the thing, not your real name.
Yeah.
And it's all good while it's good, but if the situation is like, oh, I need to fix this thing, and I knew this, it becomes a drama. Mm. And the longer it goes on, the harder it is that it may be to fix. And it might take time when you want to roll your super out to another fund, but you got to fix it and it just delays the process or something like that. So
yeah,
that's all I would say. It's the social side of the comment, you know, choose whatever name you want. Don't care. Keep your name. I've heard people join and make a new name for the family, hyphenate it, all that. Do all that.
Yeah.
Do what you want always. But I'm just saying with those particular flashpoints in your life around other people setting up stuff for you because they know you as Amy Hoddenot professionally, but that's not – so they're like, oh, let's put – oh, we're booking Amy's flights for the work trip.
Yeah,
who Amy is Hoddenot. It's like, oh, I go to check in. No, we're looking for Amy Hoddenot. You're Amy Pigeon.
I think that's,
it just can drama.
Yeah, I think that's too confusing, Chelsea. That's my personal thought as well. The fact that you're not having kids is a big one because a lot of the drama and the questioning comes in. It's like, well, okay, whose surname does the kid take? Is it the mother or the father or whoever? Like, it's just got to be that. That's a bit more complicated. So I get that, but I think generally speaking, and love to get your thoughts on this, Glenn, is this concept of. And Amy and I were speaking about this the other day. Like, we've both got pretty crap surnames, like, generally speaking. They're not standard.
I was thinking today, making my coffee before this podcast, I'm like, geez, John, you're such a bloody pigeon.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it, thinking, how antiquated, is that a word?
Yeah.
How antiquated is this concept that the female has to take the male's surname or should take the male's surname. Like, it shouldn't be that way. I think we're living in 2024 where it's a common conversation of, well, yeah, what are our options here and what's going to be best for us long term? I think it's back from the 1800s, isn't it, really?
A friend of mine just had a baby and she named him her surname.
Is that right?
Yeah, and
to I keep
believe
the name.
Old mate is also changing his name to her name.
Mm.
So it's funny. I, you know, in my existential crisis, whatever that word is, I'm like, oh, if I don't have kids, the James name of my tree
gone.
Will die.
Yes.
Because I'm the last. My uncle had girls and all that stuff. And it is a fallacy because I can't make a decision based on something I can't control. Number one, what if I go to make kids and I can't have them? I'm screwed. What if I have kids and they're all women or
yep.
girls even? I think you have girls, not you don't get a woman
women.
Born. Yeah. So it's almost like this fallacy moot point where it's just like, oh, well, if whatever, it's just a name, I can keep living and
yeah.
sure, it'd be nice to keep the family tree and all that stuff, and but also whatever.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think times have changed a little bit, but any case.
I mean, Chelsea, what you could do if you guys were going to mix it all up and have another child, and Amy was like, yeah, I don't want Pigeon as the last name anymore, you could have a child and name him Glennie, and you could make Glennie's last name Glennie Hot or Not Pigeon.
Wow.
Put a hyphen in.
Yeah, and that was a discussion which sort of made us laugh too, because like Chelsea, at least she's got a half normal surname called Evans that can you can hyphen that a little bit easier. So there's also the convenience of it all, signing your name and explaining people to people and spelling it out and all sorts of yeah.
Anyway, we are so beyond the scope of anything related to money. I just wanted to say do what you want, but just really, really, really pay. And it's going to have to be that really, really pay attention for the rest of your life with paperwork stuff.
Yes.
Because the longer you go on known by your professional name and also have your real name in the background, it's always going to be a thing.
Yes.
And it's going to trip up one day. Actually, fun fact, get this. Mum and Dad, when they sold our family home of hundreds of thousands of years old that we grew up in. So my parents aren't married, right? But Mum just went and changed her name to James.
Really? Right?
Yep. When they sold the house, the title was still in Wendy Beer.
Christian, yeah.
Not Wendy James. So she had to go and prove heaven and earth 35 years later.
Yeah.
Just everything's possible. Yeah. It's just
complicated.
Yeah. Leonie. Oh, I'm going to leave this one to you, John. We're emotionally invested in a
dilapidated
house in our ideal location that is going to auction next Saturday. Our mortgage broker has recommended we don't bid at auction as we have limited lending options and we are borrowing the maximum and risk losing a 10% deposit. We plan to go along to the auction and see how it plays out. There are builders looking at this property, but it's not likely a quick flip, so hard to tell how much interest there is surrounding it. And the price guide dropped last week from $600 to $580. We have ordered a building in Pest to be carried out beforehand. I'm not sure you'd bother if it's an old piece of crap, but whatever. If the reserve is not met and the property is passed in, how do we put ourselves in the best position to make a subject to finance an offer on the day? How do you get into a position to negotiate in an auction sale? There's actually, in reading this, John, can I tell you my first take and I'll get you to take it home? That effectively, if it gets passed in, it's just probably a private treaty sale, could be.
Depends.
Okay. Yeah. So if it gets passed in on the day and you talk with them like, yeah, they'll take $570. After the auction, if you negotiate that $570, it's still basically in the auction land where it's all final and it happens on the day. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, that's right. And generally, to put a fear of God in you, the agent will say, well, the highest bidder will get to negotiate first and we're only going to deal with the highest bidder. So people get freaked out by that and say, oh, I better be the highest bidder. But yeah, it's essentially the auction process. In some ways, you're buying off the plan because you're committing to something without actually getting finance approval. Mm-hmm. Once you buy or the fall of the hammer, you're legally now the owner and you've got next business day to put your deposit down. And if you don't pay it and don't go through with it, you lose that 10% deposit or whatever's negotiated. Mm-hmm. So it's subject to valuation once the auction falls, once the price is decided. Now, generally speaking, it's very rare for a bank not to give the valuation in on purchase price at an auction, because the auction is the most transparent way of dealing real estate, because everyone's
there. Yeah, with the market. That's the market.
Yeah, it's the same room. There's people competing against each other. It's a realization of that price. So, yeah, I see the risk, Lonnie, in respect to going to the high or our borrowing capacity maximum. So you really need to be, and the broker's probably saying the right things and saying not to bid at auction for that particular property because of it's maxing out at their borrowing capacity. But not to bid at auction at all is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, but in this situation, they're saying we're not going to participate in the auction, but if it gets passed in, how do we chat? Well, there is a chance if you're not a bidder and or the highest bidder, you're not going to have a seat at that table anyway.
Yeah. And again,
possibly.
It comes down to the agent and the whole situation. But if you haven't made any inquiries leading up to that property, you haven't been to the inspection and you just fly in on the day of and it's passed in and say, look, I want to negotiate, you might be put to the back of the line. But essentially the agent's job is to do what? Sell the property. So for someone interested, they'll allow you to talk generally.
Now, we have, in different market cycles, seen people, met people that go to an auction, it gets passed in, no one's around, everyone's like, nah, stuff this, we're out of here, and it ends up selling later for less than the amounts or reserves that they were wanting anyway.
Yes.
So I think in this situation, you are emotionally invested. You have house fever, which is fine. We've all had it. This probably isn't the right property for you because your ducks aren't lined up, aka we don't have the best lending options. We're not ready to bid at an auction this soon.
Okay.
Is that a fair comment?
No.
Okay.
I would go back to Lonnie. I would go back to your mortgage broker and say, righto, you don't want me to bid at auction. I get it. It's at the top of my borrowing capacity. I'm going to bid at auction. What's the maximum I can bid to that allows me a little bit of wiggle room? Right? Mm. Because if I go to auction, like I'd be kicking myself if I don't bid and someone buys it for $550. And the broker said, oh, you can't go to 590 or 600. That's just too high for your borrowing capacity. But if we ask the question, could I go to 560 or 570? Yep, no problems at all. All right, so that becomes my ceiling and the emotion comes out of it and I just simply go with the numbers.
Yeah, so I think, like our usual story, I probably worded that wrong. Getting your ducks lined up prior is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I need hard numbers that you can guarantee if I bought a property tomorrow, be it auction, private treaty, I could spend $570 without any issues.
Yes.
With no risk.
Yeah.
And then, sure, run along to the auction.
Yeah. And I'm sure this goes without saying, Lonnie, but you've mentioned it's a dilapidated house, so I'm sure you've taken into account what the plan, what the next plan of attack will be in terms of restoring it or knocking it over or doing whatever you're doing with it.
Yeah, but if they're at the, but this is the whole thing, Johnny. Like, we're borrowing at the maximum and risk losing a term. Like, if they're at the threshold anyway and they're buying a freaking knockover, they've got no money to freaking do anything in the short term anyway.
Yeah, so.
I do get dream location,
long-term
thing. I get that. I'm just making entertainment.
And it might be reading between the lines and saying, well, we're actually cash heavy, but this is the amount of cash we want to put in. This is the maximum they'll lend us because our income isn't any higher than that. It is what it is. And we're saving this cash for improving this dilapidated piece of poo.
So on this, she said it's a dilapidated house. You wouldn't even bother with a pest in building, would you?
You wouldn't think so. It's a waste of $600.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, we know that. And this is the problem. For me, pest in building, I really only want them to tell me hardcore structural stuff because they're going to say like, yeah, there's windows are rooted. Like, yeah, sure. The property's 50 years old, of course. Like you want them, if you're buying a house, to live in, you want the pest and building just to pick up the wholesale stuff. It's like there are categoric signs of white ants, in the footings.
Yeah.
There is a categoric water leak in the ceiling that you can't see for whatever, like, we know an old house is going to have a heap of crappy problems. It's going to probably have the spicy dust in it. Like, we know all this stuff, but for when it is dilapidated and we know it's a long-term knockover, who cares? We know that we're buying something that would fail any pest and building inspection.
Yeah. So they might just want to know, like, for example, the structure, the piers and footings are fine.
Yeah, so if they do renovate, yeah. So that could be worth the $600.
Yeah.
Again, this is the best part about this. We can talk with absolute confidence, knowing a pinch of the story from two paragraphs on Facebook. So there you go. Well, Johnson, we might leave it there. Thank you so much, everyone, for having a listen. Hey, if you want to do us a favor, forward this podcast, if you love it, to a friend or family member. We'd love to get the word out there. We don't really advertise that much, and we would love to do that. We'd love for you to share this podcast. Finally, I just want to say to John, your clarity calls,
yes.
You are increasing the price.
Yes. So they've gone up to $400. They were $350, and they actually were $400. I left it a week long before the prices actually changed online, but now it's officially $400.
Yeah, so we just had to do that. John's weeks were getting out of control with clarity calls. General market economics, increase the price a little bit, slow it down a little bit, but you still get the awesome value.
Yeah, and I will say you may go on and book or have a look at the calendar and say, oh, it's booked out for a month. Well, it is, but it isn't, because I book stuff out so that I don't get too booked, but then can slot you back in if you need to. Mm. So you can communicate with us and you can book it in, and then we can change a time that's going to work for you maybe sooner.
Yeah. And one of the reasons John hasn't been on the Tuesday show for a couple of weeks is because he's been traveling and having strokes in hospitals and I've been traveling. And so the problem with John, everyone, this is the problem with John.
Here we go.
He's got like a full-time job. And he books something in he's got a full-time lifestyle.
Correct.
And we book the podcast. It's a standing thing every Wednesday afternoon. But sometimes I can't be bothered doing it and want to change it to the next day.
Yes.
So and John has got time to do it. So I go, all right, get stuffed. I'll find someone else when I want to do it.
No, and that's absolutely a load of rubbish, because what time did we start the podcast today?
I don't know.
1 o'clock. What time is it usually booked in for? 2 o'clock. Okay.
So yeah, I had to move it.
So, yeah, and I had to move all my beloved clients and people in my firm around to suit the big dude so we can get this thing recorded.
So the only reason I've got on my head, you probably can't see it, I've got a skin thing on the top of my forehead.
Yes.
And I think it's a BCC.
Okay.
And I've had a melanoma before, so I'm hypervigilant. And this thing, it just won't go away. And I'm like, I need to go get this taken out.
Sure.
So the only time I could get in is at like at 3 o'clock today when we would have been recording.
Yeah. Look, so I'll move heaven and earth for your BCC.
By you moving this, John, you've saved my life.
And if I've done that,
you are a hero.
I'll sleep well tonight.
Yeah.
Mm.
And
but
just
next week we're out, because
talk about irony, right? So this thing on my face, you can't see it. I'm going to get this skin check on the top of my forehead. I kid you not, yesterday a pimple grew next to it.
Oh, how good.
So I'm like, oh my gosh, like the worst time.
Yeah.
This has been bugging me since Christmas, and I'm finally like, I've got to go get this checked out. Booked in. Oh, also, everyone, I did see the GP at the start of the year and said, what do you think this is? Is it a melanoma? It's like, no, but because it's on your face, go to the skin guy, because he'll cut it off cleaner than anyway, so I have had it looked at. But the day I'm going to get it probably excised, there's a freaking pimple next to it.
How good. Did you squeeze it?
No, I don't want to disrupt the whole area.
Oh, if I was near you, I'd be squeezing that thing.
Oh, far out. Yeah. So, John, we are going to Townsville.
Yes, I can't wait. I've never been there.
Neither have I. Thursday night, the 2nd. So this goes up on Tuesday the 23rd. Next Thursday night, We're in Townsville, bitches. We're coming for you. Yeah.
Pity the Cowboys aren't playing.
There's not. I do have some regrets about booking it because there's not many of you coming, but we're coming to Townsville. I think we've sold 15 tickets, but we're doing it for you, the audience, in Townsville. And I'm on purpose going to still go because I want to meet our good listeners in Townsville.
Yeah, all 15 of you.
All 15 of you. So
we can't go to Canberra where we get 100.
Can we get a venue for 40 people, please? Next minute I got 15. But hey, we're coming for you.
Mm.
This is the type of people we are. We will spend money. And this is like, thank you for paying $99 a ticket to come because we're still running at a loss.
Did you tell them that was just a deposit? They've got to pay more now because there's
less. So the $99 gets you the door cover charge. So it gets you in and then we'll be sending a collection plate around for it. How wild. But I'm going to have fun. I've got some new podcast tech gear. Did you see the reel I put on Instagram last night, John?
No.
I bought my own wireless microphone system and mixer.
Wow.
And I've got a thing that I can pack it and carry it and put it on the plane.
How good.
So we can do more live events and not have to hire $1,200 worth of microphones for 2 hours.
That's unreal.
I just bought it all just do it all myself.
Can we get a projector as well?
Working on it. Oh, actually, let's talk about that. I think I will because it might fit in this because I got a 4RU rack mount case.
Yeah.
Probably don't know what that means, but if a projector fits in it, I might buy a little projector.
Yeah, it's so wrought, that thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right, see ya.
Righto. Bye.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have 3 books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.